Harold Bloom is the resident American literary curmudgeon, a self-styled party of one against all. He is Sterling Professor of Humanities at Yale, Berg Professor of English at New York University, author of more than 20 books, including The Anxiety of Influence, published in 1973, and his 1990 bestseller, The Book of Jay, in which he took on the Bible, arguing with brilliance that some of his favorite parts of the Pentateuch were written by a woman. He has edited and written introductions to some 400 volumes of literary criticism. Everything about him is outsized, an encyclopedic intellect, exuberant eccentricity, a massive love of literature.
Thank you, sir.
Now, I'm going to just start off slightly off-center with this book because I was trying to find my baby's mouth with a bottle this morning at 4 a.m., and I suddenly had a kind of intuition that maybe what this was all about was, and you certainly mentioned this in the book several times, that there's a sense in which the Western canon itself has become too large, that no one man in his lifetime can now read it and understand it and absorb it all. And maybe part of the this movement of resentment which you are arguing against is in fact a reaction to the fact that it is now no longer manageable.
I think that's very shrewd on your part. I've been obsessed all my life with an idea that, for want of a better term, I've called belatedness the deep fear or sense that I think has haunted Western literature ever since ancient Alexandria in the opening centuries of the Common or Christian era, that we have come too late, that the great age is over. It is indeed true that if you take Western literature from its Greek and Hebraic origins down to the present moment, you have 3,000 years of the highest imaginative achievement. And difficult as it was to absorb in Alexandrian days 2,000 years ago, it is now indeed virtually impossible to absorb completely. And I would suppose that the phenomenon that I call resentment in the universities and colleges and schools, in the longest analysis, may perhaps be a version of that sense of belatedness.
Now, your new book, The Western Canon, published by Harcourt Brace, takes the canon, you argue cogently and also brilliantly for 26 central writers, ranging from Dante through Shakespeare, who you see as the centerpiece of the canon, to Samuel Beckett. You are using as a kind of model for this book a kind of modified Viconian theory of history, a cyclical theory of history, beginning with the theocratic age, moving to the aristocratic age, which Dante through Shakespeare, then the democratic age, and now the age that we're in now, the chaotic age, which you see as leading into another theocratic age. This idea that of belatedness, that the canon is now in some ways too large for one person to absorb. I wonder, you can almost sort of line that up with the when a canon, when a culture's canon, when its sacred books, in a sense, become too weighty, then the culture itself begins a kind of decline. You can almost make a correlation there, or am I going too far now?
No, you have put it very shrewdly. Of course, to organize a book on this kind of serio-comic use of Vico's theory of history, in which rather clearly and overtly and indeed by confession I am following Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, which is quite certainly one of the canonical climaxes of our age, to use that kind of a paradigm is in some sense to confess that one is indeed, once again, a very belated kind of a figure in a very belated kind of a time. On the other hand, it has its comic aspect. It was Wallace Stevens who remarked with wonderful irony that the imagination is always at the end of an era. And that, I think, has marked what, broadly speaking, I would call Alexandrianism in the last 2,000 years. And we are all of us Alexandrians, you know, whether we are Resentniks or whether we are conservatives of the ghastly Gingrichian variety.
Yes.
Or whether we are, like myself, determined last ditch, last stand, we will go down fighting aesthetes of the sort of Pateerian or Wildean kind. We are, all of us, in that deep condition of Alexandrianism, of knowing that we come after rather than before. I think I remarked at one point in the book that if we live not on average or balance the biblical 70 years, but if we double that, if we lived 140 years, then in a sense there would now be no canonical problem, no canonical dispute.
Right.
So even that is a kind of comic statement on my part. I think my book is an extremely serious book, but I hope that, like any book that has any value whatsoever, it is also a comic work by design, as Finnegan's Wake is a profoundly comic kind of an achievement.
Comic. It certainly has a very elegiac ring, at least at the introduction, at the end, which are both...
Well, I think, as I say, that we have lost the war, that readers like myself, and there are a good many of us more outside the academies now, I fear, than inside them, you know, people who really, from the time they were children, had a deep, solitary, passionate love of reading above any other activity of the heart or spirit or indeed the human, that we are more and more in the minority, that a belated age is also an ideological age, and clearly the great disease that I'm trying to fight in the book is ideology. Indeed, it does not matter whether it is the right-wing ideology of someone like that wretched fellow, William Bennett, or whether it is these endless pseudo-Marxists, pseudo-feminists, pseudo-Foucaultians, and so on, who now infest our academies.
Now, at least the left-wing group is all bundled together for the purposes of the book under the, as you call it, the school of resentment.
Well, the school of resentment, or as I charmingly like to call them, a rabblement of lemmings.
Of lemmings, that phrase appears more than once. The school of resentment is characterized by resentment, in your terms, against or towards the kind of what's perceived to be an aestheticism and an elitism.
I'm afraid that their primary resentment, forgive me for interrupting you, I deeply fear that their primary resentment is of imaginative literature itself. What they resent is the aesthetic, which they condemn as a bourgeois mystification. It is not easy, I must say, for me to get over my stunned amazement at this act on their part. After some 20 years of contemplating the spreading of this ghastly phenomenon, it still not only mortifies me, but astonishes me.
But
to believe that the aesthetic is only a bourgeois mystification. But it's always, as it were, a judgment of value made purely in the interests of the ruling classes. Such a view would have been laughed out of any academy when I was young, but now is so prevalent that those who oppose it are laughed at.
But there's a sense in which the argument for aestheticism, for aesthetics, has to be made over and over. I mean, this is one of the things that Wilde was doing and was so outrageous.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely agree with you. I point out in the book that these so-called new historicists and so so-called Marxists and others, you know, who are appropriating these terms and who form the current camp of resentment, that they are very much in dissent from Aristotelian, you might say, social science or social eugenics on the one hand, mm-hmm. and Platonic moralism on the other. The deep condemnation of the aesthetic, meaning of Homer, right. on the part of Plato, is the ultimate ancestor for these gentlemen and ladies.
Right, his in the Republic, where he wants to get in poets the outside the civil...
And by implication elsewhere.
Yes.
Just as the response that I make to them is ultimately a knowing repetition on my part of the great Alexandrian critic whom we identify wrongly by the name of Longinus, but the name has stuck in his treatise, which we translate, you know, as On the Sublime, right. though I think the title is something closer to On Strong Writing. It is Longinus who points out nearly 2,000 years ago that the contest or agon of Plato is with Homer, and that having in effect been defeated in aesthetic supremacy by Homer, never able to match up to him, magnificent writer as he is, Plato seeks to simply expel Homer, to drive him out on moral grounds.
I should just
which is indeed to reject the aesthetic in the name of the moral and
utilitarian
in the debased way that I believe is what the school of resentment is up to.
Now, I wanted to ask you, one of the central arguments of the book, The Western Canon, is actually in some ways a recursion back to your argument of the anxiety of influence, and that is that the canon itself is necessary for the production of art in terms of the agon or the conflict of the creation of art. You need something to be, an artist needs something to be competing against, something, some prior master to be defeating in battle in some, at some level.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Though you're kind enough to ascribe that to the anxiety of influence, the book, I mean, not the concept, overtly takes that notion of the arts and the literary art in particular as being agonistic directly from Jakob Burckhardt and from Friedrich Nietzsche, who took it from his colleague Burckhardt, and they in turn are merely returning one to ancient Athens, where the entire conception right. of literature was agonistic.
Where the great plays were created for contests.
Where the great plays are created in contest, where Pindar writes his odes in competition with Bacchylides and others, where Homer's contest with Hesiod is fought out so powerfully by the author of the Iliad. And Hesiod, remarkable as he is, loses.
Now, I think part of the idea of the resentment that comes in here is there's a sense in which things, because the canon exists, because of the process of the anxiety of influence, the agon of the arts, there's a certain kind of aspect that this is set in stone. What you have to do to become a great writer now is approach the canon in a certain way. There's it seems like not a way, a process of going away from the canon, of turning aside, of sitting in your own house and just writing by yourself. There's an odd sort of feeling that you have to do this now in order to be great. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Well, but it's not as though one says that the incipient playwright or poet or novelist or story writer now has got to engage the entire canon. That is clearly impossible. Nor would one even say that the aspiring writer must directly engage Dante and Shakespeare, the strongest writers in the canon, though I think ultimately, you know, when you reach a writer of the stature of Joyce or of Beckett or of Proust, they inevitably find. They are driven by the inward necessity of their art and their ambition to take on Dante and Shakespeare. But how, after all, does one become a good writer? You
yes.
can only do it by reading at least some very good writers before you, and in some sense basing yourself upon them, even antithetically in reaction against them.